This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer, reporting from Birmingham, Alabama. Come along and join me for an exploration of the town's post-Civil War roots as a premier American producer of pig iron. We'll explore the current economic development and revitalization initiatives with David Fleming, CEO at Rev Birmingham.
Because we've had a lot of this good urban fabric, historic buildings and things to adapt and reuse, there's been a lot of opportunity to create mixed-use projects.
Ty Malagani at Sloss Furnaces, National Historic Landmark, shares insights about the historic Sloss Furnaces that at one time was one of America's largest blast furnace pig iron producers.
This is a really, really cool museum that we have here in Birmingham. It's really the only museum like it in the country, where it's a 20th century blast furnace site that's currently being preserved and interpreted as a museum itself. So we're not just preserving it for people to see, but we're actually preserving it for people to walk through and see everything up close and really get a sense of what it used to be like out here.
A visit with Lashana Sorrell at the Statue of Vulcan.
He is the Roman god of the fire and forge. So yes, he's a blacksmith. He makes things, create things.
The world's largest cast iron statue perched on a mountaintop overlooking the city is followed by a conversation with Valerie Collins-Thomas, principal at the Val Group that serves as an ambassador for people considering relocating to Birmingham.
Everything comes here. Broadway plays that travel, and I can walk to those. Musicians, the last play I saw at the Alabama Theater was a Book of Mormon, and it was excellent. Even our local theater is absolutely top drawer. Down the street from where I live is the Alabama School of Fine Arts.
Frank Stitt, owner and chef at the Highlands Bar and Grill, talks about his passion for Southern cuisine and locally sourced ingredients.
To me, the provincial French kind of one-star restaurant that just worked with great local ingredients reminded me a little bit of my growing up in the South and the food of my mother and the ingredients coming just picked that morning.
His restaurant was proclaimed as the most outstanding restaurant in America in 2018 by the James Beard Foundation. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer, reporting from Birmingham, Alabama. Come along and join us as we visit with David Fleming, president and CEO of Rev Birmingham, as in revitalization. Hi, David. Let's back up in time with the city of Birmingham and its history.
Birmingham is what we call a New South City. It was founded after the Civil War. It was founded in 1871 with a very specific reason for its existence. And that reason was to be an iron and steel producing mecca. And so it was a place where all of the ingredients that you needed to have an iron and steel industry existed in close proximity. Iron ore, coal, limestone. You just needed the people to put it all together and make it happen. So after the Civil War, Alabama and the South was recovering from that. And, you know, it was decided this was the time to really make that southern city of iron and steel happen. They were very ambitious about it. They created a city, put the railroad tracks through here, named it after the greatest industrial city of the world at the time, Birmingham, England. They just declared to the world they were going to be competing with the likes of everybody, Pittsburgh and others. And it took. And within the first 40 years of the existence of the city, starting with nothing, it was one of the top four cities of the South.
And somebody I remember hearing that it had like the largest steel plant in America?
We did have one of the largest, and certainly the first large-scale open hearth style, which became the way you really did iron and steel for the next 100 years. That was here.
But that's now part of Birmingham's history, isn't it?
Right. You know, Birmingham was founded to do that and was a major powerhouse in that. But as with everything, things began to change. Technology changed, and Birmingham had to, as so many industrial cities, had to try to reinvent itself over the last several decades.
And it seems like it's done it a couple times. I mean, you had that Renaissance 1880s architecture that we walked around and looked at, 1920s, boom, and then again now.
Yeah, the story of the city is really one of resilience, and you can see it in the architecture because there were different areas or times or waves of development, and we still kind of see that just as we walk around our city. So that resilience is a part of our character here. You know, we go through a lot. We've been through a lot. We've been through a lot of industrialization, deindustrialization, trying to transform the economy, certainly dealing with social change. You go through the civil rights movement. So we've been through a lot, but we've come out of it on an end where we, I think, are in a city that has a really bright, optimistic future ahead of it.
Looking at downtown core, walking around town with you guys today, one of the takeaways for me is the blessing of the existence of some classic architectural structures and buildings that didn't get bulldozed.
Right. I think that's one of the blessings of being a city where the economy in the late 70s, early 80s was not super strong. We didn't bulldoze a lot of buildings. We learned how to adapt and reuse them instead because we couldn't just do something new and different. And that's been a blessing for us because we have this incredible urban fabric, physical fabric. When people come here from other places, they are the ones that always point out, wow, this is one of your best assets, all this historic fabric in your city that most people probably don't expect when they come here.
I presume you have some architectural tours?
Yeah, there are people that do that, yes. And so you can, you know, definitely find ways to learn your way around the city in interesting ways.
Talk to us about some of the coolest projects that are in process now or recently completed. And I know one would be the dynamic of live-work spaces.
So our city core has been transforming a lot like most city cores around America over the last decade or so. It's been a real, you know, urban period, you know, a movement back to cities. Well, that's been true here for Birmingham. And because we've had a lot of this good urban fabric, historic buildings and things to adapt and reuse, there's been a lot of opportunity to create mixed-use projects, major department stores that used to be downtown, like the Pizzitz building. It was the largest department store south of the Ohio River when it was built, and it is now got residents in it as well as a food hall and then the sidewalk moving picture independent film theater downstairs and then what was the old bargain basement. So those kinds of developments are symbolic of the kind of spirit we've got going in Birmingham right now. There are a lot more of these residential projects, people moving back to the core. You know, around 2000, there were probably less than 5,000 people that lived in downtown Birmingham. Today, it's over 12,000 and growing. So it's definitely a growing neighborhood.
As we look around right behind us, there's a brand new apartment complex with scaffolding still up.
Yeah, but one of the things that I think really helped make a lot of that happen was the attention to placemaking that our city has done for the last couple of decades. You know, we're sitting in a beautiful railroad park that was old industrial land next to the railroad tracks at one point, and it was four blocks worth of dirt that was transformed into a beautiful urban space that has won many awards, including competing with and beating some of those more famous things like the High Line in New York. And, you know, it has transformed this city because it created space for people to come.
A little word picture of the park.
Looking around, what you see is a space that has a mixture of rolling berms and grass, as well as maturing trees, a pond, as well as a major sort of civic plaza in it where the symphony will play occasionally, and then a playground for kids. But it's all done, in, you know, Tom Leader was the architect or designer that did it and designed it to be this amazing space that really you hadn't seen the type of before, and it's now been copied more around because of its beauty and its urban context. What that attracted back was people who knew we needed to build some apartments for people to live nearby, or companies that wanted to relocate. The minor league baseball team, who's been in Birmingham for over 100 years, was out in the suburbs and moved back to downtown to be across from Railroad Park. So
talk a little bit more about that, because that was a game changer, their move, even people attending the game.
So what happened when Railroad Park was built and then the Barons moved back, all of a sudden you had reasons for people to come downtown that weren't just people that were working or and that's where their job was. It was a reason to come and play and recreate. And between the two, all of a sudden you went to having almost 1 million people a year that otherwise were not coming downtown, and they were experiencing downtown in a way that they hadn't before. And it just, I think it just threw gasoline on the fire or the potential that downtown had. And now the view of this urban core is very different among most people.
Interesting how different anchor draws can help propel a downtown.
Yeah, if you do it right, you know, you find the right spot with the right design and understand the potential. What really made Railroad Park work was you already had a large population of people that were working downtown. We're just a few blocks from the University of Alabama at Birmingham, which is the largest employer in the state of Alabama. We had a growing residential neighborhood that was sort of fledgling, and you just threw this into the mix, and it just made all that really go stronger.
I remember reading about you guys have some projects that are specifically targeting specific neighborhoods with a distinctive character, revitalization.
Birmingham is a very neighborhood city. Neighborhoods here grew with very distinct character and sense of cultural identity. And in fact, there really are 99 specific neighborhoods in the city of Birmingham that are considered sort of official neighborhoods. And so many of those neighborhoods share old commercial districts, and we not only work in downtown, but we work across some of the neighborhood commercial districts for revitalization. And there is a real desire among people in Birmingham to, you know, start businesses and start and grow this great idea that they have. And we love to help them do that and be a part of this economic development ecosystem that we have of multiple organizations, the city government, really trying to grow from within, because we're the kind of city at this point that really has to continually grow businesses from within it in order to employ people. But it also helps fill up vacant spaces in these neighborhood districts.
Talk to us about the little shipping container startups that we walked by earlier. That's cool.
So there is a real great scrappy sort of startup culture here. And I think that, you know, one of the things that someone did was, you know, let's take old shipping containers and convert them into spaces that can be used for retail or other uses. So that itself was an entrepreneurial effort and idea of someone that we worked with him and a property owner in downtown to take one of the parking lots downtown and do some more good placemaking and vibrancy. And we've set up three of those containers in an effort we call Upswing in order to create a better sense of place, grow vibrancy, but also incubate small business. And so they're in place, and we'll rotate different businesses through them every 6 months or so. But it's just created more of a sense that Birmingham's retail downtown potential has really got the potential to revive.
You were telling me earlier about an incubator that you guys are involved in.
Well, one of the best incubators in North America is called Innovation Depot, and really we are just allies with that incubator. But that incubator itself is tied to UAB and tied to the civic community here. And there are over 100 companies that are incubating in that facility now, and it has spun out a lot of great success stories. Because whereas once Birmingham was an economy that was largely iron and steel, and kind of converted into a service economy around education, but then banking and insurance and construction and engineering that kind of were born out of all of that industrial, now, today, the intellectual economy is what's taking on the innovation economy. That Innovation Depot is central to the efforts, as well as UAB, to make sure that we maximize the potential. There are a lot of communities that would frankly kill to have the assets that Birmingham has, between Innovation Depot, between UAB, Southern Research Institute, and a number of these anchor institutions that make it very tangibly for real that this city is growing a lot of great technology businesses. And so that is attracting talent to Birmingham. And I think our city itself is attracting talent, because when they get here, despite what they may think they know about Birmingham, they usually find something very different. And it is a city that surprises a lot of people, pleases a lot of people. They understand the quality of life here is amazing. It's more affordable than a lot of markets. We tend to support people that are doing good things here. If you may be lost in the weeds in some other community and not noticeable, well, we notice you here, and we really embrace you and try to help you grow your business or whatever you're doing. And on top of it all, we've got the best food scene in America, I'm telling you, bar none.
Give it a little dig deeper on that one.
You know, most people may not know that last year the Best Restaurant in the Country award from the James Beard Foundation went to a restaurant here in Birmingham, Highlands Bar and Grill, and our food scene has transformed over the last few years as we have incubated a lot of great chefs and restaurateurs. And so there's a lot of incubation in Birmingham, not just technology, but food too.
Is there any specific foods that Birmingham is synonymous with? A signature dish?
Well, you know, Birmingham is actually a city where a lot of cultures came together because a lot of immigration came here as the iron and steel industry grew. It attracted a lot of people from all over the world. So we had a lot of Greek culture, a lot of Italian culture move here. We had, you know, Russian, everything happened. So a lot of it just sort of blended in with a southernness to create its own sort of thing. And so we've got our own version of, you know, the Birmingham hot dog. It's like we've got our own version of everything.
Okay, a little bit more. Think harder about some of your targeted neighborhood revitalization projects.
So the neighborhoods all offer, because they have unique history, unique cultures, they all offer something different in terms of opportunity. You might have a neighborhood like Avondale that once was a neighborhood that was essentially a company town that grew up at the base of a large, beautiful public park space that was always dedicated to be a park, but it was very heavily industrial, but it revitalized a few years ago around, of all things, beer and food. You know, the city recently, because the state, you know, had some changes to the laws around breweries, so the brewery cultures began to really revitalize a lot of neighborhoods. And Avondale is probably the signature one of those that people know about. And it created a whole different thing. I used to say that, you know, it used to be that Avondale was the neighborhood you used to drive through, but now it's the neighborhood you drive to.
This is a pretty short period of time transformation, isn't it?
Yeah, really within the last decade. Another example would be Woodlawn. And that's a neighborhood where the neighborhood was really invested in by a lot of the philanthropic community to grow kind of an equitable entrepreneurship as well as housing and education. So it's kind of a different mix of things going in there. But then you might have another community like Inslee, which was where the largest iron and steel producer was located, which closed down in the 70s and is now on the cusp of a revitalization around logistics and shipping. It's actually, there are jobs growing in that community that a lot of people don't realize around the sort of logistics industry, and it has a great historic fabric, and the city is committed to working with that community to really restore that historic fabric, create sort of an entertainment and retail cultural center in the historic area, but around that on the old iron and steel land, hopefully create opportunities for jobs and logistics.
Looking in from the outside, it would appear to me that economic affordability, real estate-wise, would be a real attraction and allure, something that you would want to market to for outsiders coming in.
We have started to get on the radar a little bit for the fact that you can, you know, buy something in Birmingham and do very well with it in terms of development. You know, the real estate costs here are certainly nowhere near most other markets, major markets, and yet the opportunities are really as profound. So,
and how about affordability, just a place to live, renting an apartment, you know, a loft?
Yeah, Birmingham is an affordable market, and if you look at any, you know, graph or study of that, our affordability as a community, not only just for living, but even just for doing business, is better than a lot of these other hot markets.
Tell us about some of your targeted initiatives within the urban core itself, which would seem to be the heart of what makes Birmingham, Birmingham.
Well, we are very committed to continued placemaking and making sure that the civic infrastructure enables the private sector to thrive. But some of the initiatives that will be coming forward, you know, we're just completing a city center master plan update, and there are some initiative areas in our urban core. We consider our city center a 4-square-mile area, which is kind of large in comparison to others, but our innovation district, the area around the Innovation Depot, got the potential to be a district of a lot of different buildings and different types of innovation businesses thriving around some good civic space investment. But that's adjacent to our civil rights district, where our history around civil rights is seen. A lot of the stuff that happened is interpreted there, but not just interpreted, it is an area that still represents African American culture here in Birmingham and the and African-American entrepreneurship. And so those two things really go together really well. Our community, we are building a new open-air stadium adjacent to our civic complex on the north side of downtown, and that is going to be where UAB, you know, plays its football games as well as other things. And so there's an old hospital campus up there that's been closed a long time that is going to be redeveloped. So there's a lot of urban redevelopment that will happen around those initiatives. And so a lot of what we have to do in Birmingham is connect these dots. And a lot of people look at our city and they realize, man, you've got so many dots, it's just connecting them that you really need to do better. And so I think a lot of our initiative needs to be around how we make sure that all of these dots do connect for a greater whole, greater good. You know, we like to say at our organization that we want Birmingham to be the most vibrant market in the Southeast where everyone can realize their dreams. You know, in 1871, when the people that founded the city, they would have said almost the same thing. They might have left off that tail end, though, about where everyone realized their dreams. I think that's what's different about Birmingham today. We all want this to be a place where everyone can realize their dreams, and the vibrancy has to be for everybody.
And the nickname of Birmingham is the Magic City?
We were the Magic City because we grew so quickly. We were a boom town that went from nothing in 1871 to by 1910, we were the third largest city in the South. So we were big promoters, and so we called that magic, you know, and that's the magic of Birmingham.
I sense magic today in that as we walked around the downtown core this morning, there was not a block that we walked that there was not a major renovation, remodel, reuse project going on, which leads me to the next level is if I came back a year or 2 years from now, the vibrancy would be doubled, be enhanced intensely.
I think you will see if you come back in a few years, a lot of the vacancies filled, a lot more people just walking on the street because, you know, we have more people living, working, and playing in the downtown area. We also are very conscious of the need to be a multimodal city from a transportation standpoint. We were pioneers in the bike share world several years ago, the first city to employ a bike share system with the electric pedal assist technology. And we're, you know, developing ways that our city is a multimodal downtown. And so I think you're going to see a lot of that driving the interest in our city going forward too.
One of the other dynamics that I picked up walking around town is it's a very walkable town. I could imagine somebody living and working and rarely going to their car.
So we have, that's a person that I know who's, they just moved here from Chicago about a year ago to take a position at UAB and one of the spouses at a local bank. They have yet to buy a car. They have lived downtown and on the south side, and they are doing Birmingham without a car, which is very rare, but clearly very doable. And it is what we want to see more of, and because, you know, one of the benefits of having been a very planned city from the beginning is that the city was laid out in a way that was sort of easy to navigate, not just in a car, but really at a time when people didn't have cars. And so we still have that footprint.
David, to learn more about your world, do you have a website, place that you'd recommend people to go to?
Our website is Rev Birmingham, R-E-V, spell out Birmingham.org. And we'd love to invite people there to see some of our initiatives like Upswing and some of our business growth opportunities and some of the neighborhoods we're working in.
David Fleming, President and CEO of Rev Birmingham, thanks for sharing.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Right now, we're with Ty Malagani, who's Museum Education Coordinator, and specifically, you're at a National Historic Landmark, the Sloss Furnaces. I love it.
Yeah, so this is a really, really cool museum that we have here in Birmingham. It's really the only museum like it in the country, where it's a 20th century blast furnace site that's currently being preserved and interpreted as a museum itself. So we're not just preserving it for people to see, but we're actually preserving it for people to walk through and see everything up close and really get a sense of what it used to be like out here.
It truly is living history in that it's almost as if the guys that operated this blast furnaces and whatnot walked away, and they could come back and fire it up again.
Exactly. I mean, that's basically the idea behind the museum when they first started preserving it around 1977, 1978, is they decided they wanted to make this as original as possible. And for all intents and purposes, the men did just shut down and walk away and when the site shut down in 1971. So we tried to keep it as close to the way it was the moment they walked away from the site as possible.
What's interesting, 1970s was not a great decade for architectural historic preservation. That's when people go bring in the developers, bulldoze this, and let's build condos or whatever. So it's interesting. How do you explain how they got it so quickly after it closed?
Yeah, so it's very funny that you mention that, because a lot of people point towards the loss of Birmingham's terminal station, or the great train station that was here in Birmingham at one point. Very ornate, beautiful station. It was bulldozed, and people were very upset about it. And so when the plans came out that this site was also going to be bulldozed and turned into other developments, at this point the site was owned by the Alabama State Fair Authority, people got upset. So people banded together. They formed the Sloss Furnaces Association, and it really was a grassroots effort. It was everyone coming together from all walks of life to make a difference and save their history. And they were the ones that really pushed forward to get the city of Birmingham to take ownership of the site, and they voted in $3 million to preserve the site as a museum in the 1970s.
It's a city of Birmingham oversight and operation. Is there a state or national overlay there of historic preservation?
So our site is operated mainly with two heads there, with the city of Birmingham, who owns the site and helps keep the site running. They're the ones who provide the budget and things like that. And then we have the nonprofit side, the Sloss Furnaces Foundation, which really handles making sure the site is continued to be preserved and so that this can still be standing for future generations. So they partner together to help keep the museum running. So that's really where we get that from. We do have a National Historic Landmark Board who makes sure that we are still abiding by the National Historic Landmark Standards and things like that. And we, of course, have a foundation board who help also run and manage the site.
So the steel industry in America decades ago was an integral part of America, was synonymous with America. And it's pretty much all gone, isn't it?
Yeah, so I mean, here in Birmingham, I mean, if you look around at all the iron industry that used to be here, I mean, at one point there was over 30 furnaces around the city area, and Birmingham made more cast iron pipe than any city in the world for many years. And even though a lot of that declined and has gone away, Birmingham still has some industry. It just looks a lot different than it used to.
Isn't there an iron pipe company still in existence here?
Absolutely. We have at least two that I know of for sure. ASIPCO, American Cast Iron Pipe Company, still has operations here, and U.S. Pipe still has operations here.
And where do they get their raw material today?
It's a great question. I know most of their raw material is scrap iron. Not 100% sure exactly where it comes from. But
they're not mining and...
Exactly. So Birmingham stopped mining iron ore out of the mountains by the 1960s. It was just starting to become less quality ore as you kept getting into the mountain, and it was starting to become cheaper to get it from places like South America. So you start seeing the shift from iron ore in the smelting process to more using scrap iron and just remelting what has already been made into product.
So Birmingham is a post-Civil War town. It really didn't exist of any consequence before the Civil War. And so it coincided with kind of the industrial age in America. And explain the reason why iron ore processing happened here.
Very quickly after the end of the Civil War, we start seeing the dawn of the New South movement of bringing industry as well as agriculture to the South so that the Southern economy wasn't so dependent on the Northern economy for making products. So you start seeing the New South movement, and so they were really wanting to build a city based on industry in the South. And Birmingham became the poster child of that. It really became the key city, mainly because all three ingredients you need to make iron ore, limestone, and coal are all found naturally in the ground within 30 miles of this area. It's really the only place in the world they're all found this close together. So without these rocks in the ground, Birmingham would never have existed, and you never would have seen the amount of iron production that was happening in the city over the next century.
Today, who comes here, and how do they find out about it?
Yeah, so the best way to get more information would be through our website, slossfurnaces.com. We have all information about the museum and everything. We are a free museum, so we're open 6 days a week. The only day where it closes Mondays. But our visitors range from a wide variety of people. We get people from all over the country, of course. We get a lot of locals. We also get a lot of European visitors. So we have about 30% of our visitors come from overseas, because this is not only the only one in America, but this is only one of three in the entire world that are like this. So we do get a lot of worldwide visitation.
And then there are people here, students, artists that work here.
Yeah, one of the most interesting aspects of our museum is the fact that we have a metal arts program. So they're still using the old traditional methods of making iron, albeit on a much smaller scale, using their own mini furnaces. But instead of making iron bars or pig iron, which is what Sloss made for all its years, they make art. So they make sculptures and things like that. And
are these University of Alabama students? Where do they come from?
So a lot of these students come from universities around town, both University of Alabama at Birmingham, Birmingham Southern, Samford, University of Montevallo, University of Alabama, Auburn University. So all the universities, students will come through here, because this is really the only place around that you have this true casting of iron experience. But then they also have, they do programs for high school students. They do programs for adult artists who just want to come in and learn a little bit about it. They do blacksmithing, welding. So anything that has to do with working with metal, they can teach it. And they have full-time artists who, after getting their degrees, they come in here and they work to teach art, make art, and help keep the spirit of making iron alive.
To learn more about that?
To learn more about that, you go to slossmetalarts.com. I think one of the coolest things about industry is that it brought so many people together, in the sense that if you look at Birmingham population around 1900, just about 50% of the population was African American. And most of these people are moving up from the Black Belt region of Alabama, Montgomery County stretch, where the soil is this black rich soil. And a lot of farmers. So we have a lot of farmers moving up to find work. You also have a lot of European immigrants. We had a lot of German, Italian, Greek, Lebanese, British, and Russian people all moving in as well. And so you're seeing the highest numbers of any southern city of this size for these populations at this time. So Birmingham really is a true immigrant city. And the cool thing about it is we still see a lot of their culture still alive today. We still see their food and their churches and their music that they all brought with them to Birmingham. And it really became this place that had all these people.
That's really cool. Time. Thank you so much, man.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming out.
Great morning. LaShana Sorrell, here we are on the top of the mountain. Tell us exactly where we are.
We are atop Red Mountain, located in Birmingham, Alabama, at Vulcan Park and Museum.
Tell us about Vulcan.
Well, Vulcan is the world's largest cast iron statue. He was forged in 1904 for an entry into the World's Fair in St. Louis. And his goal was to show people all over the world what we're capable of here in Birmingham. And he did exactly that. He's been standing here for 115 years as the unifying symbol for the entire city and the region. And we're just happy to be here to be able to show this to everyone who comes through.
And Vulcan is the god of steel?
He is the Roman god of the fire and forge. So, yes, he's a blacksmith. He makes things, create things.
That's really cool. So it really has been and remains a symbol of the town of Birmingham.
Yes, it has. I think it shows our dedication, our skill sets, what we're capable of, the vision that our founders had then, and the vision that we're currently going in the direction is wonderful and great. And I think people will be happy to see what's coming from Birmingham.
So we're on a mountaintop right in the heart of town with almost an airplane view of the whole city and the region.
Yes, it's a great view, the best in the city. We have a lot of people who come up and just take photos and selfies here, just to be able to see the entire city as a whole. We consider ourselves the front porch of the city.
And this is owned and operated by the city?
No, we are actually a private foundation, and that the city has allowed us to manage on their behalf, and so we're here.
That's cool. And there's rolling lawns around Vulcan statue, and I imagine people picnic up here.
Yes, we have a lot of picnic visitors. Also, people with small kids will bring up cardboard boxes and they'll slide down the hills, and it's a great experience. Or they walk up the 159 steps up the pedestal, so it's a great active place to be.
And right in front of us is called Vulcan Center.
Yes.
Tell us about what's inside there.
So the Vulcan Center is our comprehensive history museum. And so we tell not only the story of Vulcan, but the story of the foundation and creation of the city of Birmingham. It's a planned city, and many people are not aware of that. And so we talk about our story and our history and where that leads us to today.
So what would be some of the highlights of things that you'd want to show me in there?
All right, so I would show you the three components that make iron, and I would also show you the process that it took to make Vulcan. I think that's a very intricate process. I was amazed when I saw it a year and a half ago, and I think it's also always amazing to show that and talk about our history. We want everyone to come visit us and check us out. You can go to our website, visitvulcan.com, to see our new exhibits, to all the programming and events that we have going on. And just remember, like, we're here for you.
And I imagine you have Facebook. A lot of people like going there.
Yes, we're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. So please pay us a visit and check out some of the things there and stay connected.
Well, thank you for sharing.
Thank you for visiting.
My pleasure. Valerie Thomas, you have an interesting job, an interesting profession, the Val Group. And you deal specifically helping people that are coming here to move,
yes,
to even make the decision whether they want to or not. And that was something that you went through yourself.
Many times. I have a PhD in moving, which is why I felt so drawn to the concept, because we've had military family moves. We've also had corporate moves, and I worked with IBM.
You guys were in med school or med practice in San Antonio, and
yes,
then your husband got an offer to come to Alabama.
To come to Alabama.
And you had some real reservations, didn't you?
I did. I had very significant reservations because...
What first came to mind?
Unfortunately, even in 2010, the first thing that came to mind was Bull Connor and the dogs. That image is mm-hmm. there, and... one of the reasons I started my service is I want to be able to address what life is like now, understanding that the only impression you have of Birmingham and of Alabama is that really challenging racist history of our city. So,
isn't that just phenomenal? I mean, this is my first time here, and I had some of those same etched memories.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I intentionally came here, was to see the reality today.
For yourself. Yeah. And for me, when I drive down where Kelly Ingram Park, 16th Street Baptist Church,
yeah,
and when you drive down there and it's a few blocks from where I live and where I'm having coffee and pancakes with fresh ingredients and there's all kinds of people in the little spot where I'm eating, it is absolutely inspiring to me almost every single day that we have this geography and these spaces that we walk through as a community, and that history was yesterday, and it was horrible.
Right.
It was absolutely horrible.
But that's the other thing, because we're just old enough, it's etched into our brains as yesterday, but then we forget, you know, when kids talk about, oh, well, 30 years ago, and I'm thinking, oh, that was the 1970s, and they're going, no, try the 1990s.
Right,
you know,
right.
And so that's something we have to remember, is that time travels on, and there has been obviously some great distances traveled and a lot of amazing transformations here,
right,
that I've noticed in 2 days.
Right, right. And I think for me, I'm probably a tiny bit younger than you are.
And a big bit.
And I look at, you know, my journey in America, and we've made some progress, and then, you know, we kind of feel like we might not be going in quite the right direction, and there's some things we're going to have to relitigate and re-challenge, and that's okay. I think the whole idea, as the young people say, is staying woke. If you're just aware that there's still some work to do, and then again, living here, I just see the power of what can be done and what can be accomplished in a community and how we all get together and live together.
How do you explain that evolution and that growth of consciousness and humanity here in Birmingham?
You know, I'm not in a position to try to articulate that, because I am a transplant here. I am the recipient of the hard work mm-hmm. that a lot of people did before I came on the scene. And I am always in awe when I have gotten to speak to them or see some of these giant people who did unrewarding work at risk to their own personal safety, so that when I moved here, people accepted the diversity of my family. You know, we're a multiracial family. There was no quibbling. There was no rejecting. There was no snide remarks. And my husband and I have been married almost 30 years. So in the beginning years, you know, there were people who had expression to our family unit and not always positive. But here I've felt nothing. And again, based on what you hear about Birmingham, you would expect there to have been issues, and there hasn't been any.
So obviously, however and why ever, there has been a growth, an evolution in the consciousness of people here collectively.
Very much so. So much so that sometimes people who have lived here and who actually had that journey, they forget all that they had to do, and they'll say, oh, you know, it's just great. We don't need to talk about that, because they've moved on. They've moved on. They love it here. They know what the quality of life is. But I think it is important to continue to have the discussion for people who don't know what that collective consciousness has done. So you have to keep talking about it and letting people understand that we are an open community that's welcoming to anyone and everyone.
Naturally central to your profession and your job right now, what you do day in and day out, talk to us about some of the specifics.
My personal passion, once I changed my mind about the city, was that we're continue to be better when more people come. And the hospital is the largest employer in the state and a big engine to the success of our city and the state.
And the name of the hospital is?
The name of the hospital is University of Alabama, Birmingham. And we also have the Children's Hospital here.
And that's huge, too, in itself.
That's huge, too. And people come from all over the state. If they're looking for health care, these are the two hospitals that are going to take care of you no matter what.
And Children's probably all over the country, right?
Right. So we need physicians from all over the country, all over the world, to take these positions here. And we can't be in a position where they're stuck saying, I'm not going to go to Birmingham because of Bull Connor and the dogs, just like I did. So when I came here, I did not take a position because I was reluctant and I didn't think we were going to stay. And once I changed my mind and I had my own consciousness raising of the community, I decided that this was a way that I could make a difference. So specifically when the hospital identifies a candidate, you know, I'm not a search service, but once they identify a candidate, I will call them, talk to them. Sometimes I have to talk to the spouse and tell them what my experience, personal experience has been, so that they'll come for the visit, get them to come, and then I make sure they see their quality of life priorities during that visit so that there's not a question of what their life would look like here. And so they can make an informed decision whether we're the right city or not.
And you've lived in quite a few different cities, Washington, D.C.
Exactly. Yeah. I've lived in Washington, Atlanta. You know, I've lived in some more rural
places. Were
you
in Baltimore for a while?
We lived near Baltimore for a while, and my husband was actually offered a position at the Pediatric Burn Center at Johns Hopkins, but then a general called and said, don't sign anything until you come to Brooke. And so he went and we ended up down there.
So that he was Army Burn Center there?
Yes.
In San Antonio?
Yes, in San Antonio. He did the reconstruction for the burn service, for the burn center. And so when University of Alabama, Birmingham reached out to him, the trauma director, it was ideal for him to have an opportunity to save the patient and the skin, the burn patient, at the same time. So it was a good opportunity for him. So here we are.
So talk to us a little bit more about your life. It's probably beyond being a black woman anymore. You're just a woman, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, at this point, you know, when you're a brown American, you're always, you know, something happens every day that reminds you that you're brown. But that is a plus and a positive, and it's part of my culture and perspective of how I enjoy things that come my way. My husband is the one, by him being Caucasian and not having had this journey all of his life, he's the one that has learned the most. He can be the most protective and sometimes reactive or disappointed or discouraged, where I expect something, he for a number of years would be shocked and then ready to defend. And I said, no, we can let that one go. That's nothing. So, but yes, the one thing about the richness of America, I've always felt, and you know, as black children, your parents raise you, you've got to be the best. You know, no one's going to give you anything. And you have to, you can't take any shortcuts. So you have to be absolutely stellar at everything you do. That has always kind of been my guiding light, and now I continue. I have more resources. I have access to things. I have a lot of things I can do. But I always still try to do things the best way possible and think ahead to what could go wrong and how to mitigate that so that it doesn't happen to me or whoever I'm working with or the special event I'm working on. Because I have a tendency to be very involved in the community. And I'm very involved in this community, just like I've always been.
Yeah. Seems like if you go to work for the chamber, in a way, there's a real a community pride that I sense.
Absolutely. My tagline is I'm 85% Birmingham inside and out. I shop local. The breeches and things I have on, I've purchased at little boutiques in town. I eat from the farmer's market. Our Pepper Place market is open almost year-round. And that is something I didn't have out of all the places I live, easy access to fresh local food and lotions.
And you were saying within walking distance.
Within walking distance.
Do you have a car anymore?
I do, because I have to drive people to the suburbs for them. I mean, the big box mall is lovely down the street. It's only 12, 13 minutes from here, but that's a day trip for me. I save up 8 things that I have to do before I get in the car and go up there. But, the Pepper Place Market, eating, buy food on Saturday from the market. I know my farmers. I know where my socks come from, my lotions, my creams. I eat in chef-run restaurants, and I walk to those.
And how about in nighttime entertainment, live music, theater, and whatnot? You can do that.
There's plenty of that as well. This past weekend, it was my husband's 65th birthday, and I kept asking him what he wanted to do. He gave me no answers, so I planned a weekend for him. We saw Anthony Hamilton at the Alice Stevens Center, which is the university's performing arts center. On Sunday, we went to the Les Dames, Les Coiffeurs dinner, where our women chefs prepared a dinner out at this barn at a spot I hadn't even been to. I did have to get in the car to go to that. And then we went to dinner at Bistro 218 on his actual birthday and just walked around the corner to that. And amazing menu, great food. And everybody knows us now because I pretty much don't cook now that I live here. So I just eat at my restaurants. If I don't finish it, I take it home and I eat it for breakfast the next day. I have a very non-traditional breakfast many days a week because I'll eat soup or a salad or whatever. And we have everything comes here. Broadway plays that travel, and I can walk to those. Musicians, the last play I saw at the Alabama Theater was A Book of Mormon, and it was excellent. Even our local theater is absolutely top drawer. Down the street from where I live is the Alabama School of Fine Arts. Those students do the spring dance recital. You think you're on Broadway. It's very impressive. So I don't feel like we are missing anything except the high cost of living and the traffic that it takes to get to something or decide there's too much traffic, I'm not going.
I love it. You're pretty spoiled.
It's true. I say it all the time. We're so spoiled
here.
How
did I know that?
When you're eating, I'm sure you know this, that our Beard awarded the best restaurant, chef-run restaurant in the country, Frank Stitt's restaurant, Highlands Bar.
I just was with him at lunch. What a nice guy.
Yes, he's
You would never,
the best.
Yeah, just humble.
Yes, he's the best. His wife, Pardis, what they have done, I consider them the godfather of our cuisine because they did the heavy lifting of making a spot for our farmers to bring their food in.
And he was trendsetter.
I can't even imagine what it would be like without his effort. And then what has happened over all these years, he's trained so many sous chefs executive chef, the pastry chef.
Super award winning.
She's also the award winner, but you know, they've trained all these people. Well, they may have their own vision for a spot, but they leave Frank, but they can't leave the city because Frank did all the hard work of, you know, bringing the fresh produce, meats, vegetables, eggs. You can't leave. No, I think you've got our food. And we've got a great energy, and we're just the spot. I have the PhD in living life and moving people around.
There you go.
And getting relocated.
So we'll have to get you a diploma. Then.
Yeah, I need a diploma for sure. I'm definitely certified.
I love it. Well, Valerie Thomas, thanks for sharing.
Well, thank you, and it's a great pleasure to meet you as well.
You too. Somebody wanted to learn more about you?
My Instagram is alive and kicking, and it's just called at the Val Group. So you can follow me at the Val Group.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
My name is Frank Stitt. Here in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm the chef and the owner of Highlands Bar and Grill, Chez Fon Fon, Bottega, and Bottega Cafe. They called it the Magic City because it was a booming, thriving city. And so this little part of Five Points is where Highlands, hence the name Highlands Bar and Grill, came from back in 1982 when I opened.
Very cool. This really has a small town feel to it. It's like its own little community and world.
Well, that's exactly it. In Birmingham, you get to know people. It's very easy to plug in to whatever you want to be a part of. And so here at our restaurants, it's very much the bartenders know your name and the regulars come. And so you have a relationship. And so when you do have a relationship with people at your restaurants, then you really get to be genuine and sincere, and it's not just one person coming in as a tourist that you'll never see again. And so that creates a whole different energy in the community and, you know, in the restaurants.
So you go back to the early 80s here.
Yeah.
Was it a risk-taking kind of sobering moment for you when you decided to do that?
I remember my mother had to take out a second mortgage on our house in Coleman, and her house, and everything was used equipment. We opened on a shoestring. No banks here would loan me the money, and so I had to get a bank in Coleman. Got a few friends to invest a little bit of money, and so yes, it was a big gamble. I wanted to have basically do world-class food, but not in a fancy setting, and I wanted it to be a place where you could have the best oysters and the best cocktails and fantastic wines. And I remember starting having crab cakes on Thursday, and there would be a line out the door for lunch. And so the community accepted us and believed in us and supported us.
Let's back up in time how you got into the world of culinary arts. Did you get it as a little kid?
I was not at all interested in cooking. My mother was a fantastic cook, and she was also a great gardener. Her parents had a farm where they milked Jersey cows. My grandmother churned cream for butter. And just had a really prolific, they had bees, they had fruit trees. And so one of the highlights was going out to harvest with my grandmother. And so I loved to eat. And so the cooking bug didn't hit until when I was in college. I was in Boston for a couple of years and then moved to the Bay Area to go to UC Berkeley. And that's where I fell in love with French food and French culture and was able to apprentice under a Swiss chef, worked through a number of kitchens.
Chez Panisse
was certainly the most influential. They were, you know, one menu, whatever Alice and the chefs thought was at the best, that was their choice. And it was more about creating an experience for themselves and for the diners than it was just a monetary, you know, pursuit.
Did you go to CCA, or where did you go?
No, I did not go to culinary school. I worked as an apprentice, worked my ways up, and read. And that's at Chez Panisse, was introduced to Richard Olney, who became my mentor. I was able to meet him in London and be his assistant for a short while there, and also at his home in Solliès-Tucat, outside Toulon in the south of France.
Did you study, like, classical French?
I certainly did. Classical French and provincial French. My Elizabeth David was a big influence. And so to me, the provincial French kind of one-star restaurant that just worked with great local ingredients reminded me a little bit of my growing up in the South and the food of my mother and the ingredients coming just picked that morning.
So what you're saying is, like, Provençal or your rural South, what drives you is that authenticity, that freshness, that real product.
Well, exactly. And I've studied philosophy at Berkeley, and that was what I realized, is that if I could pursue authentically and with sincerity and with knowledge and with passion, then whatever I did, I didn't know if I would cook or write about food, grow grapes, make wine, but I knew I was going to do something with food and wine. And I was able to hitchhike from Paris to Provence to work the Vendange, and spent 2.5-3 weeks at a friend of Stephen Spurrier. And those were some of the happiest days of my life, of just working so from sun up to sundown, but you were part of the cycle of making, changing an agricultural product into a thing of beauty.
Spurrier, he reminded me of the great movie Bottle Shock.
Oh yeah. His famous tasting in 1976, where he was able to bring some attention to the quality things that were going on in California.
Upset the French.
That's right, with the French judges. His place was called L'Académie du Vin, right off Place Madeleine. He just kind of took me under his wing, and I remember tasting every wine that Domaine Lefleuve made, from Le Mont Rocher to Batard Mont Rocher to Chevalier Mont Rocher, all the way down the Premier Cruise. And it was just an incredible education. He was very generous.
Tell us a little bit more about your philosophy of cuisine. For example, this is my first time here, but what I picked up was total unpretentiousness in presentation, letting the food itself show. Am I on target?
Yeah, you're not going to see a lot of tricks or a lot of powders or frozen and dried and balloons, and you're not going, to me, I really am about the essence of the food and the flavors, the textures, the excitement.
You have nothing to hide behind.
And it may not be the newest or the most different thing, but I want there to be an aesthetic balance that is pleasing and is provocative and stimulating and nourishing on many levels. And so that's where I'm coming from.
One more little taste of your cuisine and that Alabama flavor.
Yeah. We have the church bells. Right now, I was just a local farmer was bringing in some mustard greens and turnip greens, and they are fantastic right now. There's a coolness that has brought out even more flavor, and so when I can elevate, whether it's those greens or sweet potatoes that are another crop where I'm from in Cullman that we're famous for, and put their names of that farmer perhaps on the menu and to elevate those humble ingredients, I think that speaks to our roots in the South being very connected to the land. And I also think that it speaks to the seasonality of celebrating the joy of sharing food and drink with friends and guests.
Frank, if somebody wanted to learn more, where would you direct them?
Well, you always want to learn from the best. And so you think about who you have. If a local restaurant is in a style that you are interested, whether it's Chinese or Vietnamese, and they're doing authentic and good food, you want to go and talk to them and say, you know, let me help out for free. Let me know who you were inspired by. What books inspired you? And that's where you peel that onion one layer at a time, and you just keep your curiosity drives you to pursue whatever it is that you're interested in. And in food, that's how I would pursue it. And you'll the doors will be closed in your face, and then eventually a door will open. And hopefully that will be a person with a good heart. My name is Frank Stitt, here in Birmingham, Alabama. I'm the chef and the owner of Highlands Bar and Grill, Chez Fonfon, Bottega, and Bottega Cafe.
Love it. Frank, thanks so much for sharing. What a great day.
Well, nice being here with you. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, it's hard to leave, though. Thanks again. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Alabama. We'll see you down here.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
Associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Molly Blaisdell, San Francisco, and Katya Singel, San Luis Obispo, California.